Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Prisoners of war on both sides of the conflict in Ukraine have told UN human rights investigators that they have been subjected to torture and ill-treatment while they were held. Matilda Bogner, head of the UN's monitoring mission in Ukraine, said that over the past few months, her team had interviewed 159 prisoners of war, or POWs, both men and women held by Russia, and 175 male prisoners of war held by Ukraine. Ukrainian POWs have said that they were frequently subjected to prolonged beatings, threats, electric shocks and dog attacks. 9 people are said to have died during such attacks in April this year. Both men and women prisoners reported being subjected to various forms of sexual violence. Russian prisoners of war held by Ukraine told interviewers of summary executions and several cases of torture and ill-treatment. Ms. Bogner said that states must treat all prisoners of war humanely at all times, from the moment they are captured until their release and repatriation. The UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, is calling for the immediate release of thousands of people who are being held in Iran, arrested for their involvement in peaceful demonstrations, amid an increasingly harsh crackdown by authorities. OHCHR says that, as of a week ago, more than 1,000 indictments had been issued against people arrested in relation to protests in Tehran province alone. Hundreds of other indictments have been issued in the rest of the country. On Sunday, an unnamed protester was sentenced to death, having been found guilty of waging war against God and corruption on earth for allegedly damaging public property. At least 9 others have been charged with offences that carry the death penalty. OHCHR is calling on Iranian authorities to immediately impose a moratorium on the death penalty, to refrain from charging capital crimes, and to revoke death sentences issued for crimes not qualifying as the most serious crimes. As the Atlantic hurricane season comes to an end, the World Food Programme, WFP, is warning that extreme weather is threatening food security in Latin America and the Caribbean, one of the regions most affected by climate-related disasters such as floods, storms, droughts, and heat waves. Some 1.3 million people have been affected by hurricanes and floods in the region. In some places, harvests have been totally destroyed, exacerbating the hardship of communities affected by extreme weather events. WFP says that it is working with governments to ensure that food stocks are as secure as possible, with proposed measures including elevating houses and reinforcing buildings and harvests. Stockpiling food is also deemed to be critical. Meanwhile, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has told delegates at the G20 summit in Bali that we are on the way to a raging food catastrophe. Without coordinated action, this year's crisis of affordability may become next year's global food shortage. Nikki Chadwick, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day today. If you would like to call in and visit in the green room, unfortunately, the show today is all pre-recorded as early as this morning. That's right. Coming up is Democracy Now! This morning's Democracy Now! I'll be back with you.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. NATO representatives held an emergency meeting in Brussels today after 2 people were killed in a missile strike in Poland near the border with Ukraine. Earlier today, the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, said the weapon was likely fired by the Ukrainian military as part of its air defense, not by the Russians. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had initially blamed Russia for the missile strike. This is the Polish president, Duda.
Nothing, absolutely nothing indicates that this was an intentional attack on Poland. So what happened is a rocket hit our territory. It was not intentional. It was not a missile targeted at Poland. The fact is, this was not an attack on Poland.
On Tuesday, Russian forces pounded Ukrainian cities and energy facilities, causing widespread blackouts in what Kyiv reported was the largest missile attack since the start of the nine-month-old invasion. Earlier in the day, President Volodymyr Zelensky asked G20 members to support his peace plan to bring the war to an end. The White House said CIA Director William Burns met with the Russian head of foreign intelligence earlier this week and warned against using nuclear weapons in the highest level in-person meetings yet between the U.S. and Russia. Burns then traveled to Kyiv to reaffirm U.S. support for Ukraine. Meanwhile, President Biden asked Congress Tuesday to approve an additional $37.7 billion for Ukraine, including for the purchase of weapons. A Georgia judge overturned the state's six-week abortion ban Tuesday in a major victory for reproductive justice. The law had previously been blocked in 2019, but went into effect in July after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Fulton County Judge Robert McBurney found the ban violated the U.S. Constitution and Supreme Court precedent when it was originally enacted in 2019. Donald Trump announced he will run for president in 2024. He spoke from his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for president of the United States.
The announcement followed a lackluster performance by Republicans in the midterms, including by many high-profile candidates Trump endorsed. It also comes as the former president is embroiled in multiple investigations. The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is considering issuing a contempt of Congress referral after Trump skipped his deposition Monday. Meanwhile, in New York City, former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg testified Tuesday against his former boss, Donald Trump. Weisselberg said he didn't pay taxes on $1.76 million personal expenses and received many perks, including access to a luxury apartment. Trump's businesses are accused of over a dozen counts of fraud and tax evasion by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. In Washington, D.C., House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy won the Republican nomination for Speaker with 188 votes. He'll need, though, to secure a majority, at least 218 votes, in January to become the actual House Speaker. Republicans lack just one seat to take control of the House, with GOP candidates leading in four of the nine races yet to be called. In other midterm news, Senator Raphael Warnock has sued his home state, Georgia, for forbidding early voting on Saturdays before his December 6th runoff with Republican challenger Herschel Walker. In immigration news, a federal judge on Tuesday blocked the Biden administration from continuing to enforce the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy to expel migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border without due process. Over 2 million migrants have been expelled to Mexico since Title 42 was first enacted in March 2020. Biden officials repeatedly extended the policy, even as migrants and advocates denounced deadly conditions and human rights violations in Mexico. Tuesday's ruling stemmed from a lawsuit filed by the ACLU. In more immigration news, immigrant rights activists in Philadelphia are prepared to welcome a group of asylum seekers arriving today on the latest bus sent by Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott to sanctuary cities. Texas has spent some $20 million to bus over 13,200 asylum seekers to Democratic-led cities like Chicago and New York, with Abbott raising $400,000 in private donations to pay for his anti-immigrant effort. A new classified report by U.S. intelligence officials finds the United Arab Emirates sought to influence U.S. foreign policy through a variety of legal and illegal means. The revelations detailed in the Washington Post are unusual, since investigations of this kind do not typically focus on allied nations. According to the report, the UAE spent more than $154 million on lobbyists since 2016, as well as hundreds of millions of dollars on donations to U.S. universities and think tanks that produce policy papers favorable to the Emirates. In one of the more damning exposés, the UAE hired three former U.S. intelligence and military officials to spy on political dissidents, journalists, and companies and hack into computers. The Brazilian president-elect, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, addressed COP27 today, declaring Brazil is back on the world stage. Lula called for the next COP to be held in the Amazon, which under the rule of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro suffered major deforestation and deregulation of extractive industries as indigenous and environmental leaders were systematically killed and attacked. Meanwhile, as high-level climate talks continue here at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, young activists are demanding decisive action from governments. This is 11-year-old Indian climate activist Lisapriya Kangujam, who has been demanding the U.S. and other wealthy nations compensate poorer countries that bear the brunt of the climate crisis. On Monday, she confronted British Environment Minister Zach Goldsmith over the U.K. government's arresting climate activists from Just Stop Oil and other groups as they carry out daily acts of civil disobedience. Listen carefully. When are you going to release the climate activists? The 11-year-old climate activist Lisapriya Kangujam asks the UK Environment Minister, who then walks away to avoid her questions. She later explained why she confronted Goldsmith.
Climate activists should not be arrested, should not get arrested for peaceful protests. And also, he can't do anything. But I want to ask him that, why is he a minister if he can't do anything? Why he is in COP27?
After our headlines, we'll spend the rest of the show here on the UN Climate Summit. Back in the U.S. or Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, Jennifer Siebel Newsom took the stand Monday, Tuesday in Harvey Weinstein's rape trial. Siebel Newsom, who's a documentary filmmaker and the wife of California Governor Gavin Newsom, says Weinstein raped her in a hotel room in 2005 where he had lured her under the guise of a business meeting. She's the fourth survivor to testify at Weinstein's Los Angeles trial. He's already convicted of rape and criminal sexual assault in New York in 2020, though he's appealing that case. Construction workers at a Tesla Auto Gigafactory in Austin, Texas, filed a complaint with the Department of Labor Tuesday over unsafe working conditions and wage theft. One whistleblower said their employer provided fake credentials in lieu of giving workers essential training about the job. Others say they were not compensated at all or did not receive earned overtime. A worker simply identified as Victor told The Guardian he and his colleagues were ordered to keep working in a flooded area that was covered in live wiring, prompting Victor to tell his wife, "I'm going to die in this factory." Other locations of Elon Musk's Tesla factories have been repeatedly cited for worker rights violations and hazardous conditions. The U.S. Labor Department has accused a major cleaning company of using child labor on graveyard shifts at slaughterhouses. The federal agency says Packers Sanitation Services, Inc., employed at least 31 children, the youngest just 13 years old, at three JBS meat plants in Nebraska and Minnesota, and that the company likely employs far more children across its 400 other locations. And Walmart has agreed to a $3.1 billion settlement with state and local governments nationwide over its role in the devastating opioid epidemic. The deal will need to be approved by 43 states before it can be finalized. As part of the agreement, Walmart will have to submit to oversight measures, work to prevent fraudulent prescriptions, and flag suspicious ones. Earlier this month, CVS and Walgreens proposed similar settlements for roughly $5 billion each. Over 500,000 deaths in the U.S. over the past two decades have been linked to opioids, both prescription and illicit. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And as I was saying before I pushed the news through, you can always call in. Now, you may not be able to get on air, but it's call in at 646-716-8652. If you'd like to say hello to somebody on your lunch hour while you're listening to the news, feel free to call in. Here we go with the in the second hour.
Rebecca Solnit, Hollow City, the destruction of San Francisco in the late 1990s.
More than a third of the venture capital in the country was pumped into the Bay Area. At one point, it was coming in at the rate of $20 million a day. Evictions quadrupled between 1995 and 1997. Huge numbers of people, the equivalent of a small town every year.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's right, coming up in the second hour, following this Radio Eco Shock.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
In just days, our planet's population will cross a new threshold. The 8 billionth member of our human family will be born. These milestones puts into perspective what this climate conference is all about. How will we answer when baby 8 billion is old enough to ask? What did you do for our world and for our planet when you had the chance? Excellencies, this UN climate conference is a reminder that the answer is in our hands. And the clock is ticking. We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator. The war in Ukraine, other conflicts, have caused so much bloodshed and violence and have dramatic impacts all over the world. But we cannot accept that our attention is not focused on climate change. We must, of course, work together to support peace efforts and end the tremendous suffering. But climate change is on a different timeline and a different scale. It is the defining issue of our age. It is the central challenge of our century. It is unacceptable, outrageous, and self-defeating to put it on the back burner. Indeed, many of today's conflicts are linked with growing climate chaos. And the war in Ukraine has exposed the profound risks of our fossil fuel addiction. And today's crisis cannot be an excuse for backsliding or greenwashing. If anything, they are a reason for greater urgency, stronger action, and effective accountability.
That was United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres opening the COP27 Climate Conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, November 2022. Welcome, welcome. In a few minutes, you will hear Remarkable Science, a new feedback loop of wildfires and self-perpetuating heat has erupted in the last 3 years, but it's in the Arctic, of all places. This has not been reported in the news, but it shows up on satellite images. Don't miss David Gaveau. But first, you may ask, should this program be about the COP27 climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt? It's going on right now. Young climate leader Greta Thunberg calls the COP27 climate conference a scam. At least 35,000 people used fossil-burning aircraft to attend the 27th Conference of the Parties, or COP27. It was held this year in a Red Sea resort compound in Egypt. Many people flew in private planes with only a few on board. It is a festival of fossil fuel burning to solve the problem of fossil fuel burning. Also in attendance, about 630 known fossil fuel lobbyists. For those keeping score, that is a 25% increase of fossil fuel pushers over the previous COP26 held in Glasgow last year. Profits for big oil, gas, and coal companies are stupendous. It's out in the stars. Individual multinational oil and gas companies are raking in sums larger than the national budgets of many of the countries attending the climate meeting and many who suffer from climate change. Big oil and gas isn't a Sharm el-Sheikh just to delay any climate-saving actions that could hurt their profits. Of course, that's always going on. The fossil pushers will also be looking for side-room deals to sell more oil and gas and coal to consumer countries. They are panicked by breakdowns of Russian energy and a split in the world energy supply. You hold a conference about global fentanyl addiction, and hundreds of dealers show up selling in the back rooms. Get a hit. That is where we are. Aside from the burst of aviation gas into an overloaded atmosphere, we can presume 35,000 people from all over the world will return home to spread both COVID-19 and the flu as those pandemics continue. No, it is not over. There is some good news. The World Health Organization announced a 90% drop in COVID deaths since February, down from 75,000 a week confirmed COVID deaths last February to around 10,000 deaths a week at the end of November. We know from later statistics on excess mortality, those numbers are far lower than the real picture. Over 2 million new cases of COVID-19 were reported last week, with self-testing at home not reported, millions of people with no access to tests, and governments that don't report. That is a wild underestimate as well. The WHO says the five countries with the most cases were Japan, South Korea, the United States, Germany, and China. Of those countries, Japan and South Korea are reporting rising cases. This COP27 in Egypt will further spread disease and seed new variants of COVID all over the world. That's just the cold facts. Prior to the pandemic, when the COP climate meetings were held in countries with civil rights, we could partly justify this fossil burning party as a chance for well-meaning people to meet one another and to figure out action. As in Copenhagen in 2009 and Glasgow last year, there was hope of getting truth to power. At least climate activists could get media attention, so the rest of us don't feel so lonely with our climate knowledge. That could not and did not happen in Egypt, a military police state that jails bloggers and beats protesters. This whole COP27 is being held in a faraway resort that looks more like an exotic military compound following several terrorist attacks there in recent years. But maybe that is representative of where we are and where the authoritarian drift as billions of people experience climate-driven disasters and other stress, as this fossil civilization slowly decomposes. As Greta Thunberg says, national leaders and billionaires do not need these climate meetings at all. We don't have to wait. The science is in, and so are the extreme weather damage reports. Any humans with a claim to power could begin the emergency actions we need to rescue a livable future for ourselves and for all following generations. After 27 huge meetings, human greenhouse gas emissions just continue to increase each year. We set another record last year. The promises and grand plans are just hot air. The whole conference of the parties is just a stall. How could it be anything else? According to the COP rules, any world plan to save the climate has to have complete consensus of all participating countries, almost 200 of them. Not a majority vote. A single country like the United Arab Emirates, which sent fossil fuel lobbyists, 70 of them, to the COP, or Saudi Arabia, or the fractious American Senate, or China, could just say, no, no thanks. Never mind that major world leaders are not attending this one anyway. The head of the world's biggest emitter, China, will not be there. Big producer Russia will not send Vladimir Putin. And big consumer India, well, Narendra Modi is not coming either. No real global action can be reached without them. We're just kidding ourselves. And how could it be anything else? Let's be real. paralyzed by fear of freezing in the dark or economic collapse, there is no mass movement calling for an end to fossil fuels. Nobody wants gas stations closed in their cities. Major car makers like Toyota have already announced more production of gasoline and diesel vehicles in the next few years than the atmosphere can possibly handle. Just like the billionaires, most people in developed countries are quietly hoping the fossil party goes on as long as it can. Maybe we will take a last few holiday trips and stock up on goodies before the hard times. Until the culture of media and academia and work decide to risk wrenching change, the base of political support is not there. No matter what their illusions of power, politicians cannot go too far ahead of willingness by their citizens to go along. So Elon Musk, the new owner of an online company, has ordered the remaining thousands of Twitter workers back to their offices. Some businesses are tossing off the energy-saving work solution of being online. We will just go back to the old model, which is killing us by the millions. With this radio show, experts try to peer into the future. We want to see what is coming and what to avoid at all costs. Over 1,000 interviews and a lot of research on my part and my personal opinion is the future is a series of hard falls and difficult rearrangements for the survivors. More beans in the basement is not a long-term solution. The survival food business crashed itself a few years ago. And I can tell you from 10 years of personal experience back to the land, well, most of us cannot really support ourselves outside organized society. Maybe some could by going back to settler technology or even medieval times, but not many. That is a problem. Suppose your social system goes into a series of crashes. Stocks go way up and then way down. A random billionaire kills off a global communication system. Things don't show up on the supermarket shelves. You can't find a doctor, and the hospitals have a two-day wait time, even for emergencies. That's going on right now in the Canadian province of Ontario. A hard shift in civilization is not the big day it crashes event that survivalists imagine. It is a series of shocks, each with their own demands for change, whether you like it or not, and each providing a kind of a shock that, well, it weakens us and it confuses us. We are missing a layer of preparation. At the top, we hope national leaders and big business will come up with something to save us, even at COP27. As individuals, we can make backstops like stored food and community building. I do those. There seems to be nothing in between the top and the bottom. This is the lair where civil society used to be before the ongoing pandemic and before the strategy of stoking hate and anger and division as tools of power and control. Consider radio. When radio dominated media in the 1930s and 40s, the family had one receiver set. People gathered in the living room to listen together. It was the same when television came out in the 1950s, one in the living room. Today, most people are separated into private experiences for a large part of their day and evening. Many of us have our own screens and headsets. We think we are linking up with thousands of people on Instagram or the late Twitter, but look around. We are alone, individuated, due to technology and by design. Volunteer groups and nonprofits can tell you. Local musicians and actors can tell you. Participation and donations are way down. The middle layer of society, community action, is dying, or at least it's in a coma. Why should I risk my health in a climate march when I can change the world with a post online? Big business is ready to provide you with that crippled individuality. Mark Zuckerberg wants to sell you an alternative universe. Just move into your avatar and your virtual space. Everyone can collect hits and followers. Strangely, during a pandemic, we live to go viral. Google quietly collects everything about you and sells your profile to the highest bidder, which could be a state actor that hopes to help you collapse and die. Somewhere deep in the human psyche, we are still predators and sometimes cannibals. 35,000 predators and cannibals fly to a climate meeting in the land of the pyramids. You write the punchline. I know this is all very dark. Schopenhauer would be proud. We can be more than this. Beauty, love, and happiness are not gone. When the hurricane, fire, or flood comes, people come out to help. Sometimes we risk our lives to save others. Countless thousands go daily to keep the food bank running, to teach kids, to help. That better spirit is in us too, and may yet come. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's dig into the science with our first guest.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
While COVID and war captured world attention, Arctic wildfires are accelerating. 44% of Arctic burns in the last 40 years came in the last 3 years. The pace is accelerating, and scientists warn the Arctic is approaching a new tipping point that could push more warming on the whole world. The paper is Unprecedented Fire Activity Above the Arctic Circle Linked to Rising Temperatures. A major author is forest mapping expert Dr. David Gaveau. He has published over 60 papers and appears regularly in the media and advises NGOs and has been part of the UN process at times. From France, David Gaveau, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hello, Alex. Thank you for having me.
First of all, most people picture the Arctic as a treeless waste of ice and snow. Where are the forests then?
You've got taiga forests growing quite far north. Then the tree line starts to, the further north you go, the tree line starts to shorten and eventually disappears, and then we're entering a tundra biome. Our work focuses on an area of Siberia above the Arctic Circle, so we call that the Siberian Arctic, an area about 5.5 times larger than the size of France, so perhaps the size of Western Europe a little bit more. So I would say that most of this area is tundra and less taiga forests, although there is some, but really what we're looking at here is fires on tundra grasslands, although a little bit also in forested regions further south.
Very little credible news and analysis gets out of Russian Siberia. How did your team estimate the increase in fires?
Right, so we were alarmed by the results when we found them. We are satellite people, and we've been monitoring forest fires, essentially burned areas, you know, the area of land that burns by fire. We've used satellites in various regions of the world, primarily working on Indonesia, and we sort of applied our techniques. We modified them to work out, to measure, to estimate the area of land that burned in the Siberian Arctic every year since 1982. For this, we used various satellite sensors, some of which were already in space in 1980. So we were able to recreate a time series of annual burned areas since 1982 to 2020 using satellites such as Landsat, Sentinel-2, AVHR, and some burned area products derived by NASA using Aqua and Terra satellites. We put all these data sets together. Some images we analyzed ourselves, the Landsat data and the Sentinel data, and we were able to show through this that we see more of the Arctic, of the Siberian Arctic, burning today than ever before. I mean, our window is only looking at 4 years, but in the last 3 years, like nearly half of what actually burned in the last 40 years, burned in the last 3 years. That was a shocking result for us because we fear that a tipping point has been reached. I say this because we show that the rapid warming of the Arctic has led to more extreme wildfire seasons. We find that a temperature threshold has been crossed beyond which a small increase in temperature will lead to an exponential increase in the area burned in that region. And in 2019 and 2020, average summer temperatures in the Siberian Arctic have been above 10 degrees Celsius. They were, in fact, I think in 2020, it was nearly 13 degrees Celsius, 12.8 or something, air temperature, summer, June, July, August. And that represented, it was 3 degrees warmer than a typical summer in 1980. The average air temperature in summer, so from June to August, was greater than 10 degrees only four times in the periods under our study, which starts in 1982, only four times in 2001. And then the last 3 years of the study period, 2018, 2019, and 2020. And these 4 years, including 2001, turned out to be the years with the most fires too. So really the Arctic heats up, we know some studies have already shown that the Arctic heats up faster than the rest of the planet. But what we are actually showing is that this amplification is causing abnormal fire activity in the region. And that's worrisome, because this is an area which normally doesn't burn. I wouldn't say that fires are not uncommon, because you do see fire activity every summer, but not on the scales that we've measured. We've measured that 3 million hectares of land burned in 2020. This is our most accurate measurement using Sentinel-2 satellite imagery from the European Space Agency, a 20-meter spatial resolution. This is as good as it gets to measure burned area over large spatial scales. I'm talking of an area of 286 million hectares, size of Western Europe, a little bit more. 3 million hectares burned in that single year.
For decades, forest experts discounted the role of wildfires as a source of additional carbon and climate change. They said shrubs and trees will return to recapture any carbon they lost. But is it now burning at a rate faster than it can be recaptured by growth?
Well, this is an interesting question, and I actually don't have the answer. The carbon that is obviously, the more fire, the more burning, the more carbon and CO2 and methane are released into the atmosphere. I don't know where it ends. There was an interesting study that did look at the where did the carbon that burned in Australia during 2019 and 2020. There were massive fires there. And some of that was actually recaptured by blooming phytoplankton somewhere in the ocean. I forgot where it was. I think the paper had actually located that region. So there are mechanisms by which this carbon is going to be sequestered again by nature. So, you know, potentially by blooming algae or phytoplankton in the ocean. But the reason why we think that this result is a worrying result is because the area in this region of the world is covered in, this tundra is essentially a swamp. It's a swamp with the soil is rich in carbon. We're talking of permafrost, we're talking of peatlands, Arctic peatlands. And this frozen permafrost is actually a sink of carbon. It's been, sometimes they can be thousands of years old. They've accumulated carbon over the time because the region is cold and they can trap and sequester that carbon. But because of the rising temperature, and the Arctic is warming, I think, more than four times faster than the planet as a whole, this warming is impacting this permafrost, which is thawing and drying. And through this, fires do start to occur on those soils, and they release carbon. And obviously, the more burning will happen, the more carbon will be emitted, because there's a lot of carbon stored in that soil. And that's the worry, because what we show might be just the beginning of more and more carbon released into the atmosphere. And then at this point, the question is, will the planetary system be able to capture, re-sequester all this carbon? That I don't know, and perhaps I don't think so. But I think that's the worry across the world. Those carbon sinks, those peatlands have been degraded by human activity. Our work in Indonesia have showed this. In Indonesia, it's a little bit different, because the carbon soils are also swamps, but they're covered in lush tropical forests. And, there's been lots of deforestation, and the swamps have been drained through drainage canals. And as a result, there has been an increase in fire activity on those degraded peatlands, deforested peatlands, essentially carbon sinks, lush tropical forests have been turned into carbon soils, degraded tropical peatlands, degraded and drained. So the story is different, but slightly similar. We are also in the presence of peatlands. There aren't many trees. We're in the tundra, although there might be places where there's forest. But the point is that those peatlands, if they become sources of carbon, this is not good news for our planet, because historically, naturally, nature makes them be carbon sinks. And we go out there and then, you know, we create these disturbances and then they become net emitters of carbon. So that's not good news.
Yes, peat is one of my greater fears, actually. In 1997 and 98, Indonesia became the world's third biggest greenhouse gas emitter just because of peat fires. And you published a study in 2013 on Sumatran peat fires. Have you published maps and papers and all that sort of thing about how much peat there is in the Arctic? Do we know sort of the total threat that's waiting up there?
Well, it's a good question again. And for our work, we show that as well as having more burning each year in the Siberian Arctic, we do see also that more carbon-rich peat soils are burning. We found this map that was published in a paper in PNAS, where they were presenting a map with measurements of the carbon content of the peat. As far as I can tell, I think the largest peatlands in Siberia are not in the area that's currently, you know, that's been burning, that we've seen burning. I mean, well, there is some, but the largest share of it is more in Western Siberia, a bit at lower latitudes. And as far as I can, we didn't actually look at that region specifically. Essentially, there's a lot of peatlands in Siberia, and you don't want to, you know, we don't want to disturb it. That's as simple as that.
Is your study limited to Eastern Siberia in this paper, or would it apply to other locations like the boreal forests of Scandinavia and Canada?
Right. So we chose the region of the Siberian Arctic for a reason. We started off looking at the entire Arctic region, so Greenland, northern Canada, Alaska, and northern Europe, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Russia. What we found was that the region of the Arctic that historically burns the most is this region in Siberia that we focused on. But I have seen some maps in some recently published papers that tend to show that this is also the region of the Arctic that warms the fastest. But it doesn't mean that as, you know, as we go on into the future, that more of the Arctic will burn and other regions will be impacted. I mean, I do know that there are already fires in Alaska. Fire, again, was, I think it was also published in PNAS not long ago, and they made the predictions that temperature increase would double the area of burning in Alaska compared to the sort of the historical average. Well, we actually confirmed this prediction, but we showed it for the Siberian Arctic, and we showed that it's already doubled, because the paper had predicted that it would double by 2050 in Alaska, and we show that it's already happened in the Siberian Arctic. So it's all going along the same direction. But initially, we've looked at the entire Arctic, and then we said, okay, we'll focus on this region because this is the one that's been burning the most. And we think it's because there's a sort of, it's warming faster than the rest of the Arctic. And I don't quite know why. It's probably due to sort of, you know, atmospheric circulations and so on. But I think that's the case.
Well, as you pointed out, a paper by Mika Rantanen and colleagues revealed the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the world, and that just came out this summer. It's fairly new news. But we also know that wildfires need a source of ignition. Heat is not enough, and there are not as many humans in the Arctic, although Russia has more Arctic settlements than any other country. What is lighting up the northern forests? What starts these fires?
Right, so it's a bunch of things, but what we show in the paper that they're all linked to temperature. So at the end of the day, it's warming, you know, the ultimate cause. When the surface of the land warms, when the air above it warms, we tend to see more water vapor coming off the water surface, coming off the land surface or the surface of the vegetation. Because the water molecules on the surface of the land and the vegetation, they become more excited. They've got more energy, more kinetic energy. So there are more chances for them to be able to break this bond that keeps them attached to the liquid and go out in the air. But also the air temperature above it, because it's warmer, it's expanding. So it's able to hold more water vapor in the air. So this process by which water vapor flows from the surface of the land and vegetation away into the sort of the atmosphere above it is this process of vapor pressure. And as the air warms and the surface temperature warms, we do see that more water vapor is sort of being sucked out of the land surface into the atmosphere. And we are talking of a vapor pressure deficit. So what happens is that the land surface is actually getting drier. But then this water vapor ultimately goes up in the air and it's warmer, so it'll eventually end up, but that's also depending on circulations. And there's this paper that was also published around the same time as ours, talking about polar jets and so on. But so this moist air, this water vapor in the air, eventually will start to condensate and to form thunderstorms, and there'll be lightning. And what we're essentially showing is that this rising temperature is also generating more thunderstorms and more lightning strikes, and therefore more sources of ignition, because you're right, through this region that we've looked at is really sparsely populated. It's one of the lowest human population densities in the world. So it's not the ignitions do not come from people, although field surveys would also be needed to sort of verify this sort of this claim. But all signs tend to point to the fact that we do see more convective energy in the air. Particularly around June, end of June and July, and that's causing more ignitions and therefore more fires.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Our guest is Dr. David Gavo, expert forest analyst with harsh news from the Arctic. Earth crossed a tipping threshold in the far north.
Well, while I have you here, I know you have a lot of expertise on Indonesian forests and the loss of them. I understand Indonesian pulp and paper giant April has announced they will double production, but they say the additional fiber will come from their concessions and suppliers with no loss of intact rainforest. Can your system of mapping and satellites pick up whether that is true or not?
We're developing and maintaining a system, a monitoring system that monitors deforestation on an annual basis, going back 20 years, but also in near real time on a weekly basis. And we're looking at this deforestation in a number of concessions, whether they are oil palm or pulp and paper. April is one of the concession, one of the companies that we monitor, among others. It is fair to say that deforestation in these concessions has decreased quite dramatically in the last few years, just like it did overall in Indonesia. So in that sense, there's been much, much less deforestation. But when you look at the 20-year period, when you look at the amount of damage that April and its sort of, and the other, and APP, the two sort of largest players in the pulp and paper industry in Indonesia, they've caused a dramatic amount of deforestation, and particularly on peatlands, because we talked about peatlands earlier, but peatlands were pretty much left untouched until the early 1990s, because naturally, peatlands are swamps. It's not really conducive for agriculture. The soils are also very acidic. So to turn a peatland area into an agricultural farm is costly. You need to cut the forest. You can sell the wood. That's good. But then you need to excavate, do drainage canals, quite a few of them. So you need to have heavy machinery with you. And then at the end of the day, the soils that you get, there will still be some flooding and at some point but also the soil's acidic. So they're not great. And up until the 1990s, they were left on their own. But then ABB in April, precisely in the 1990s, pioneered the conversion of peat swamp forests to, well, mainly acacia and eucalyptus monoculture plantations through, you know, mechanized clearing and so on. And this pioneering, they did this because they didn't want to have problems with communities around them, because nobody used to go on those peat lands. But then the clearing opened roads and navigation waterways. And so as the years progressed, more and more people also obviously looking for land, and more people were able to afford to rent heavy excavators and so on, through farmers associations and so on. So there's been they've opened the floodgates to peat land conversion in Indonesia and the subsequent problems that were faced with fires, but also subsidence, flooding and so on. But it's fair to say that if they're telling you, okay, well, you know, we've done a lot of progress, we no longer have deforestation, we no longer clear the forests that are in our concessions, there's some truth in there. They've also, April has also acquired a number of restoration concessions. It's a concession, but it's not to clear the forest, it's to restore it, or at least to maintain it, to protect it. So they have that. They're very proud about that. But I think they should do more, because we're talking hundreds of thousands of hectares that they've cleared to grow acacia and eucalyptus. And there's talks of more processing facilities and expansion and so on. I think they will have to be very careful, because they've made these no zero deforestation pledges, and a lot of eyes are on those activities. There's been a bit of progress, but it's nowhere near enough compared to the damage that was done.
Well, getting back to the Arctic, what is the tipping point you and your colleagues warn about in the paper? Talk to us about the 10 degrees.
Right. Well, this is the observation that we made when we looked at the relationship between our burned area estimates annually since 1982 to 2020. And when we compare those burned area estimates with air temperature, with summer air temperature, sort of the average temperature for June, July, and August, but also against surface temperature and vapor pressure deficit and climatic water deficit and so on. When I go back to the air temperature, we did indeed find that the correlation was, there was a near exponential relationship between air temperature, but also surface temperature, the amount of burning every year. So because it's near exponential, there's this, at one point, there's a sort of a threshold above which a small increase in temperature will generate a very large increase in burned area. And for air temperature, this threshold is 10 degrees. For surface temperature, this threshold is 17 degrees. That's what we observed. We observed that when a summer in the Siberian Arctic, on average, is above 10 degrees Celsius, we do see more fires. We start to see like an acceleration of fire activity. Only four times in 4 years that we've looked at did the summers surpass 10 degrees, and only four times in 2001. But then the last 3 years, 2018, 2019, and 2020, you see, what we're seeing is that, and what we're predicting is that in the future, more and more summers will be warmer than 10 degrees, and they will see more and more fires as a result. Now, I don't have the full understanding of what this 10 degrees mean biologically, you know, or biophysically at least. But what I could say is that temperature is driving a lot of different fire factors, like lengthening of the summer season, earlier snow melt, longer growing season. So what we also evidenced in the paper was that there was a greening of the Arctic in the last 40 years. More vegetation also means more fuel, more that can potentially burn. We also show that climatic water deficit was going up. In other words, plants are receiving less water through the roots than they need to be able to thrive, because they have to give out too much through evapotranspiration, through this sort of vapor pressure deficit. And so that creates a climatic water deficit, essentially plants are stressed because they don't have enough water.
Your team uncovered a positive feedback loop where warming drives more fires that will bring more warming. I know it's a little early to say, but do you think additional greenhouse gases from Arctic wildfires could be big enough to speed up global warming the world over?
I think the risk is real in the future because of so much peatlands that could, you know, essentially thaw and dry and burn. But when we look at the numbers currently, I think we were showing that, was it like between 150 and 200, I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but like around 200 million tons of CO2 equivalents were emitted into the atmosphere in 2020. That's a lot. It's about the emissions from a country like Spain in a year, but it's less than the estimates for emissions from peatland fires in Indonesia. In 2015, we measured, I was on a team of scientists who measured, quantified the carbon emissions from the 2015 fires. And the lead author was Huygen from a university in the Netherlands. And we found that in 2015, it was not 200 million tons of CO2 equivalent, but it was 1.2 billion tons of CO2 equivalent that was emitted, like five times more.
That's pretty worrying. So, David, as we wrap up here, could you tell us about the role of your website, thetreemap.com, that you founded?
Well, we have another website. It's called the Nusantara Atlas. It's a website that specializes in the monitoring of deforestation in near real time, but also fires, specifically in equatorial Asia. So we're looking at Indonesia, we're looking at Malaysia, and soon PNG, Papua New Guinea. It's called Nusantara Atlas. So it's got maps. It's a bunch of interactive maps. It's essentially bringing in satellite imagery, process data on deforestation, but also a rich cadastral information into one space. And people are able to verify if there's deforestation in the concession and so on. We also have a blog section where we regularly post articles, stories, when we find something going on that we think people should know about. Like it could be positive news. Hey, we see that deforestation is declining in Indonesia. This is good news. But it could be negative news where we say, oh, well, yes, but locally we do see increasing deforestation in the national park, for example. And so we try to keep people informed. This website is primarily for Indonesian NGOs who work in the field of forest conservation in Indonesia, to sort of help anybody understand what happens on the ground, you know, to make sure that it is fair, transparent, and democratic. Because the site is called Nusantara Atlas. We're hoping to be able to expand it into the future. In fact, we're now thinking of at least expand this to the sort of the Arctic region, where we could just monitor deforestation, you know, fires and deforestation, but primarily fires in near real time. But that's the sort of the main website. The Tree Map website is, I must say, I need to sort of rethink it because that was built 2 years ago in a rush after I came back from Indonesia. I was actually deported from Indonesia in 2020 before the pandemic in January for reporting burned area estimates in 2019 in Indonesia. They were double the official estimates. So I came back to my home country in France and I set up the company, The Tree Map, in a bit of a rush. I set up the website and I haven't done anything since.
Right. Well, I will get that new website from you and I will post it in my blog at ecoshock.org so listeners can find that. And we're all looking forward to the day when any of us can look at deforestation anywhere in the world and make sense of it so we can be a witness to what is happening here. We have been speaking with Dr. David Gaveau. He is co-author of the new paper, Unprecedented Fire Activity Above the Arctic Circle, Linked to Rising Temperatures. It's published in the journal Science on November 3rd. David, thank you for taking the time to speak with our listeners.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. It was a pleasure to be there and to be able to sort of explain a little bit what we did. And hopefully some things are going to change, you know, with the global climate talks now taking place at COP27. I mean, there's a sense of urgency. We're seeing it all around us. Hot summers in Europe and so on, now this thing in the Arctic. And so let's hope that some good decisions are going to be made at COP27 this week.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is former Vice President Al Gore addressing the COP27 climate conference in its opening days.
Your Royal Highnesses, Your Majesties, Heads of State, Excellencies, Ladies and Gentlemen, distinguished guests, it is a great honor to be able to play a part in this opening ceremony of the 27th Conference of the Parties. Mr. President, thank you. Mr. Secretary General, thank you for your leadership of the entire world. We are all here today because we continue to use the thin blue shell of atmosphere surrounding our planet as an open sewer. Today, as every day, we are spewing 162 million tons of man-made heat-trapping global warming pollution into the sky. It adds up and accumulates and lingers there. On average, each molecule lingers 100 years, and the accumulated amount now traps as much extra heat as would be released by 600,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs exploding every day on our planet. That's why we're seeing these disasters. And the pattern is very clear. It's getting steadily worse. We have a credibility problem, all of us. We're talking, and we're starting to act, but we're not doing enough. It is a choice to continue this pattern of destructive behavior. We have other choices. In my faith tradition, I learned a teaching that is common to all three of the Abrahamic religions, that God has set before humanity a choice between blessings and curses, between life and death. We face that choice today. We can continue the culture of death that surrounds our addiction to fossil fuels by digging up dead life forms from eons ago and burning them recklessly in ways that create more death, including 8.7 million people every year that die from the air pollution, principally caused by the burning of fossil fuels. The curses that we are continuing to choose are ever more apparent. We saw them on that amazingly powerful film, one-third of Pakistan underwater, 1,700 people killed. A heat wave in China that lasted 70 days with the heat above 40 degrees, 104 Fahrenheit, over a vast area of China. Stronger storms, bigger downpours, rain bombs, worse floods. Another million displaced in Nigeria 2 weeks ago. Another million in Chad a few days after that. The Nile Delta being salinated, just as Hannibal's fields were salted. We are causing the salting of the greatest agricultural area in Egypt, as well as in the Mekong Delta and elsewhere. Droughts are drying up the mighty Mississippi River in my country, the Tigris and the Euphrates in the cradle of civilization, the Po River in Italy, the Loire in France, the Rhine in Germany. All over the world, the greatest reservoirs in North America, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, are reaching what is called Deadpool status. Starvation and famine in the Horn of Africa, devastation in Madagascar. And the areas of our world that are presently considered by doctors uninhabitable because of the combination of heat and humidity are relatively small today, but they are due to expand to the point where experts are predicting as many as 1 billion climate migrants crossing international borders in the balance of this century. Think of the millions that are crossing borders now and the xenophobia and authoritarian populism that is caused by a large surge of refugees. And then imagine, if you will, what a billion climate refugees would do. It would end the possibilities of self-governance. We have to act. We know that tragically, across the nations of Africa, these impacts are even worse, and in the Pacific Islands and elsewhere, and the poor suffer the most. The late Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, climate change is the apartheid of our times. We don't have to choose curses. We can choose blessings, including the blessings of renewable energy. We are now in the early stages of a sustainability revolution that has the magnitude of the Industrial Revolution and the speed of the digital revolution. If we invest in it and stop subsidizing the culture of death, we can save ourselves. Dollar for dollar, each dollar spent in renewable energy creates three times as many jobs as dollars spent in fossil energy. And this sustainability revolution is massively deflationary at just the time when the world is trying to find new ways to battle inflation. The International Energy Agency has called solar energy the cheapest energy in the entire history of the world. And Africa can be the renewable energy superpower. Africa has 40% of the entire world's global potential for renewables. The potential for solar and wind in Africa is 400 times larger than their total fossil fuel reserves. And these are real possibilities. This is not pie in the sky. If you look at all of the new electricity generation installed worldwide last year, 90% of it was renewable because it is cheaper almost everywhere, and in 2 years it will be cheaper in 100% of the world. But it is not enough to simply increase our support for clean energy if we are simultaneously backtracking on our commitments against developing and financing fossil fuels. The world's leading scientists and energy experts have told us that any new fossil fuel development is incompatible with 1.5 degrees as the limit to the temperature increase. Mr. Secretary General, you said we are on a highway to climate hell. We need to take our foot off the gas. We need to obey the first law of holes. When you're in one, stop digging. We have to stop making this crisis worse. We must see the so-called dash for gas for what it really is. A dash down a bridge to nowhere, leaving the countries of the world facing climate chaos and billions in stranded assets, especially here in Africa. At a time of turbulence in the global energy markets, the wealthy nations of the world should not confuse the short term with the long term and should not be fooled by the absolute need to backfill the shortage of fossil energy caused by the cruel and evil war launched by Russia in Ukraine as an excuse for locking in long-term commitments to even more dependence and addiction on fossil fuels. We have to move beyond the era of fossil fuel colonialism. And that's what it is. The dash for gas in Africa is a dash for gas to be sent to wealthy countries. We have to remove the barriers to the trillions needed for climate finance. And the scale of what is needed can only be provided by the private sector. I support governments paying money for loss and damage and adaptation, but let's be very clear that that's a matter of billions or tens of billions. We need $4.5 trillion per year to make this transition, and that can only come by unlocking private access to private capital. In the United States and in Canada, if you look at all of the financing of renewable energy, 96% of it comes from the private market. If you look at Africa, much lower amount overall, but what percentage of it comes from private markets? Not 96%, 14%. 86% comes from governments. Why is that? Because, for example, if you want to build a solar field in Nigeria, even though it's profitable, you have to pay interest rates that are 7 times higher than the interest rates paid by OECD countries. That is unjust. It is insane. That is what the World Bank and the multilateral development banks are supposed to address. We need to reconvene Bretton Woods and completely revamp and reform the World Bank system and make access to private capital available for developing countries. This is a moment for a global epiphany. It is not time for moral cowardice and reckless indifference to the future of humanity. If you want an example of reckless indifference, just recall the banker who said earlier this year in discussing the impact of the climate crisis, "Who cares?" When he was fired, it reminded me of the famous writer who said that in the highest reaches of business and politics, a gaffe is often when someone accidentally tells the truth. The truth is that all of us have limitations and weaknesses and vulnerabilities, but as human beings, we also have the God-given ability to rise above those limitations. The greatest leader of my country, Abraham Lincoln, once said, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." And that is the way we can save our world. More is needed. But we have the basis for hope. Just days ago, the people of Brazil chose to stop the destruction of the Amazon. Earlier this year, the people of Australia chose to start leading the renewable energy revolution. Earlier this year, the people of my country chose leaders who enacted at long last the biggest and most ambitious climate legislation in the history of the world. The world has passed and enacted the Kigali Amendment. We have the basis for hope. If we actually do reach true net zero, the scientists tell us temperatures will stop going up with a lag time of as little as 3 to 5 years. And if we stay at true net zero, half of all of the man-made CO2 will fall out of the atmosphere in as little as 25 to 30 years. But we have to choose blessings instead of curses. We have to choose life over death. If we are truly to make this COP the one that drives implementation of the pledges made in Glasgow, we must equip ourselves with every tool and resource to facilitate our path to true net zero and work together to drive impact and increase accountability. I want to applaud the Secretary General for making transparency around these net zero goals a priority. And I'm proud that 2 days from now, Climate Trace, a nonprofit coalition of artificial intelligence experts and data scientists and researchers and NGOs, will announce the first inventory of site-specific facility sources of greenhouse gas pollution, the most detailed inventory ever assembled that can be used to identify exactly where all this pollution is coming from. There is a path that we can make from here to a future with hope. As a final point, I started by saying that we have a credibility problem, but we also have the ability to address it. And if anyone doubts that we can summon the political will to do what is necessary and to save our future, always remember that political will is itself a renewable resource. Thank you.
That was Vice President Al Gore speaking at the United Nations COP27 Climate Conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Stay tuned for more of The Rotten Truth and Tiny Hope next week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
love will live in troubled times. Hearts can give when storms come. A human wave can come together. Minds arise as surely as the seas. Divine forms in the minds of many. We believe in the heat. Days flow by to our times of trials. Minds in motion with the beat.
PUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Rebecca Solnit, Hollow City. The destruction of San Francisco in the late 1990s. A new generation of writers such as Rebecca Solnit, Mike Davis, and Gray Bracken are intriguing us into seeing our familiar surroundings with new eyes. They also offer a different perspective on the radical transformation that development and venture capital have brought to so many cities. San Francisco, formerly famous for taking a traveler's heart away, is now reaching for the soul and the wallet. A dot-com boom combined with a growing biotechnology industry have driven housing prices up and residents and local small businesses out. Rebecca Solnit, with several books to her credit, says she wrote Hollow City in a hurry to document the beauty and rich culture that was being destroyed and to inspire the growing movement of resistance. The book itself, published by Verso, shows no mark of any hurry. It is beautifully illustrated with photos by Susan Schwarzenberg and other collaborators. When I met with Rebecca Solnit for this interview, we started out by leafing through the book together. Here's what she had to say about the illustrations.
My nickname for this book is The Yearbook of the Evicted, both because it has as many pictures as a yearbook and because so many things that were threatened or destroyed, like the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church, are documented here. Susan did some extraordinary pictures. She has a panorama on the back cover where you can see the wonderful artist Rico's extinct mural, construction cranes, debris, small in the background, one of those really sinister and evil Think Different appropriations that Apple Computer did, where they'll steal the face of some famous person and attach it to their product. Another one that's really a favorite of mine is called Condiment City. It's a picture of a young Asian couple looking out from the sinister Metreon complex in Yerba Buena Center, built right on top of what was once single-room occupancy hotels for old retired laboring men, workmen. And it's this very sterile, plastic-controlled environment. In the foreground, there's a tray of hot dog condiments. And in Susan's picture, you can see in the sense that the whole city has been laid out like a tray of hot dog condiments. And so she with this young couple kind of gazing out through the plate glass into this sterile skyscrapers that almost look like Houston or Dallas or anywhere, and that's the Condiment City.
Tell me about Mary's Cleaners at Polk and Turk Street.
It's a wide photograph she took of a just one of those little kind of working class places, a little diner with a wonderful kind of Tuscany mural on its back wall, and it's in the process of being torn down. So you see this idyllic landscape that's the mural, and you see through the windows that and door of the front of the cafe, and but within it there's no chairs, there's no table, there's no restaurant, there's nothing but the debris and chaos of rubble because it's being torn down. And you know that what replaces it won't serve the same people. What replaces it won't have that kind of modest and slightly eccentric character. It will be. It might be a chain, it might be a tech development, but it's going to be a lot more sterile.
You also included like a small documentary series by Kate Joyce in the back of the book regarding Starbucks, and that's something many people face in their cities.
Kate is a wonderful young photographer who took on this project for us. It all began when I went to give a tour of Beat San Francisco, the subject of my first book, particularly the Beat in the Western edition, the visual artists and poets and how they interacted with the African-American community. There was a wonderful gallery called the Batman Gallery, one of the first great alternative spaces in San Francisco. The artist Bruce Conner was very involved in. And when I went the day before the tour to check out all the locations I was going to show people, the Batman Gallery, which had become a classical music store in the 1980s, had become a Starbucks. And that degeneration of cultural life from this wonderful, independent, insurrectionary, artist-run gallery to a chain outlet for chain coffee, the sort of cookie-cutter homogenization, suburbanization of cities, really just staggered me. And I realized that every Starbucks is the site of a lost history. Every Starbucks is the site of a lost complexity. And so Kate, out of the conversations Kate and Susan and I had, came this idea of tracking the history of a bunch of Starbucks. You can see what used to be an Italian hardware store, Ratto Hardware, for 50-60 years is now a Starbucks. You can see what used to be the Gomez gas station for many years is now a Starbucks, that the Batman Gallery is now a Starbucks, that El Bandito delivery service is now a Starbucks. You can see, almost like a science fiction movie where all these different people with their own lives and imaginations all become zombie clones. A lot of these things, if you speed them up and see them fast, really function the way horror movies in the 50s did. But this is not a horror movie about that's an allegory for communism and its dictatorships the way 50s horror movies was. This is a horror movie about capitalism and its homogenization and erasure. Millennial horror movie that nobody's really made successfully yet, but should.
You actually dedicated a whole part of your first chapter to the first eviction documented in this book, the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church moving.
Yeah, the spring of 2000, after long negotiations, the African Orthodox Church of St. John Coltrane was evicted by the new owners of their building. They had been there 29 years, and what happened to them was classic. Somebody bought the building for a ridiculous amount of money, and which of course meant that they wanted to make ridiculous rent. So it was what we call an economic eviction. They just raised the rent way beyond what the church could afford. The Coltrane Church was this wonderful little storefront church founded by a man who had ties to the golden age of jazz in the Fillmore District. And so it was really a site of memory, of cultural preservation, as well as of spirituality and a kind of innovation that I think makes San Francisco important and significant, this idea that Coltrane's music was a kind of means of access to the spiritual that really used jazz as a sacrament. It was a wonderful place with a lot of admirers and followers around the world, as well as a congregation that fed the homeless and did other charitable work in the neighborhood. It had been there for 29 years when it was evicted, and a year later it's still homeless. It's still housed in another church in what we call couch surfing, when you live on a friend's couch because you don't have your own home. So the church, like so many other nonprofits and small businesses and organizations, is couch surfing. And in this little storefront that was a spiritual center and a part of the African-American cultural memory for so long, it's a sniffy little boutique that sells spangly, stretchy little sweaters. And that's the kind of cultural degeneration that Starbucks is about, when the Batman Gallery becomes a Starbucks, when the Coltrane Church becomes a sweater boutique, and things like that. I'm not averse to coffee and sweaters, but I think that these cultural and spiritual community places are really much more important, and you need to have a city where there's room for all of them, not just for the commodities.
This is not only a really vibrant document of a period, but it's also, you did a lot of research about facts and numbers that really surprised me, because I hadn't done that in any systematic way. I realized rents were going up, but not how fast and by how much.
Yeah, I actually managed to pull up a lot of information, some of it off the internet, a lot from interviews, newspaper archives, and things like that. And I was surprised, too, by how dramatic things were. More than a third of the venture capital in the country was pumped into the Bay Area for the last few years. At one point, it was coming in at the rate of $20 million a day. Evictions quadrupled between 1995 and 1997 and have stayed at that high ever since. Huge numbers of people have been evicted. I'm like the equivalent of a small town every year is forced out of the city. 85% of the people who are evicted leave the city. More and more of them leave the Bay Area. So there's this enormous loss. There's just this massive personnel turnover. Walking over here, I was really thinking about mining, which is an issue I've worked on. Mining towns are, they strike a vein, they create a boom town. There's this whole rhetoric about how it's good for the community because it brings jobs and prosperity, but the vein runs dry and it becomes a ghost town again after they've destroyed the ecology. And the dot-com thing has belly-flopped. I kind of feel like we're a mining ghost town. So much has been driven out that I'm not sure can come back. But now the dot-coms used up their resources and are leaving too. And the statistics really helped to paint that picture, to recognize that complexity. A lot of what was shocking to me is that so much money came into the city, but it didn't really function the way that the sort of FDR New Deal rhetoric of prosperity does. There was not a car in every garage and a chicken in every pot. There was, a lot of the pots and garages were evicted. And the experience most people had, including the people who were part of this wave of dot-coms, was an experience of scarcity, scarcity of housing, scarcity of parking, scarcity of room to move around because there were too many cars and we're in constant gridlock and the sidewalks were blocked with cars, scarcity of time, scarcity of space. So in a profound way, it was really an experience of poverty. Although, again, that's one of the intangible things that statistics won't bear out as clearly as you might like unless you look at how many hours you'd have to work to pay rent on minimum wage, things like that. But the statistics really bear up even those intangibles. One of the things I looked at is how much rent the great artist Bruce Conner, who's now world famous but was a struggling artist here in the 50s, making minimum wage, paid on his apartment in 1957. It took him and his wife 65 hours a month to pay their rent, 65 hours of minimum wage rent. With housing prices the way they are for a comparable apartment in San Francisco in 1999, before prices went up even more, that couple of struggling artists making minimum wage would have had to work more than 40 hours a week each to pay that rent, and that was before taxes, before anything else was taken out of their paycheck. And you can see through statistics and through anecdotes that we've just made the city impossible for a lot of the young people who came here and became the great artists who changed the world, moved here and became the great activists who fought for human rights, fought for the environment, fought for social justice.
Now, San Francisco was really caught between two major forces. One was the proximity of Silicon Valley. The other one was a really welcoming pro-development policy of our current city administration and the mayor, Willie Brown.
Yeah, there was definitely a sort of pincher's move with those things. And most of the cities in the Bay Area willingly welcomed this social Darwinist struggle over housing that takes place when you do everything you humanly or inhumanly can to develop jobs and you don't address the fact that every new job you create creates a need for housing. So, for example, Willie Brown's big project that he worked on both as a private lawyer in the 1980s and as our mayor in the 1990s is Mission Bay, which will be this colossal biotech complex. Last time I checked, it was slated to create 36,000 jobs, mostly high-paying, and yet it's only creating 6,000 units of housing. You don't need to do a lot of advanced math to realize that that creates a a net deficit of more than 30,000 housing units in a city that's recently had less than 1% vacancy. And so when Mission Bay is complete and the biotechs start to move in mass, we'll see another wave of these evictions, of this annihilation of the complexity of the people who not only do creative and alternative and idealistic things, but the people who provide the basic services that are always underpaid, taking care of the elderly and the young, education, garbage collection, fire departments, all these things that you really need to have any kind of a viable community. And so we're really destroying ourselves in the name of this false prosperity, and that's one of the things that hadn't been adequately clear. I think you could have sane development policies where you tied jobs to houses. If you're going to create jobs, you have to create the housing for them. This clearly doesn't work. It doesn't even work for the people who have those jobs, because a lot of them are having disastrous lives. They can't find a place to live. Their huge salaries all go for housing. They can't find daycare. I think just the stress, anger, resentment, anxiety levels in San Francisco, if we had graphs on those, you would have seen them go through the roof the last few years.
Let's talk some more about Mission Bay for listeners outside of San Francisco. Mission Bay is actually aptly named because it used to be the bay. It's a huge landfill area. When they pushed away the sand dunes to build housing, they filled the bay. And that land, I do remember clearly as just a huge open space with railroad yards. And now it has received some attention because the new stadium, baseball stadium, was built on the edge of it. You actually recount the history of who got hold of this newly created land.
Mission Bay could almost stand for the economic history of the American West. It was a bay. The Ohlone Indians paddled around in it, their reed boats gathering the abundant shellfish. And as they leveled San Francisco to develop it all, they filled it in the 1850s and 1860s. By the 1870s, the Southern Pacific and Central Pacific Railroad, the biggest monopoly of its day, had managed to get a hold of this land and made it the hub for Southern Pacific, which is the model of an evil monopoly corporation. Southern Pacific was to the transportation infrastructure what Microsoft is to the communications infrastructure of the present. Southern Pacific virtually ran California and even national parts of national government like a fiefdom for decades. It was an extraordinarily evil and corrupt corporation that was written about in the great novel The Octopus, for the way it was destroying poor people, acquiring huge land bases, manipulating politics and agricultural prices. And then railroads kind of subsided. Mission Bay eventually became kind of a not a ghost town, but a ghost yard. And it became one of the last open spaces in the city, although it was full of toxics from the railroads. There's a what we call a vehicularly housed homeless community there. And it just had that kind of open and abandoned space, what Susan Schwarzenberg calls the dream space, the space that's left for imagination, that in cities everywhere is being erased as vacant lots and empty spaces and open spaces are filled in. So the new Mission Bay, which Willie Brown spearheaded, as I was saying, as a private attorney, working for the Southern Pacific-owned Catellus Real Estate Corporation, will be the biggest development in the history of San Francisco. It's, I think, 300 acres. It's going to have millions of square feet of workspace, and what it's going to specialize in is biotechnology with UCSF, I think, as an anchor. Gray Brecken, the great urban historian of San Francisco, has a really nice apocalyptic scenario. Mission Bay is landfill, which liquefies and shakes like jello in an earthquake. It's full of toxic waste, and about the worst possible scenario you can imagine is a bunch of biotechnology, biogoop, as he calls it, spilling all over the place in a toxic waste liquefaction of the land. And so there's a lot of reasons why Mission Bay isn't a good idea, ecologically, socially, economically. One of the reasons I wrote about Mission Bay, too, is that the dot-com thing was clearly a bubble that was going to pop, but a lot of other high-tech things coming out of Silicon Valley, the hardware and software and biotechnology, are not going to go away that easily. In medieval warfare, you had these peasants you armed with sharp sticks or farm implements or something who were sent in like waves to kind of soften up the enemy troops, and then the knights came in on horseback, armed to the teeth, and protected with massive armor. I see the dot-com kids as the peasants with sharpened sticks clearing up San Francisco, and the biotech people are the knights on horseback coming after them after the city's been softened up for the real attack.
This is an archival program by TUC Radio, a conversation with the author Rebecca Solnit about her book, Hollow City. It is a record of the first dot-com boom from 1998 to the year 2000 that changed San Francisco. And indeed, Mission Bay is now covered with buildings and a second stadium, all built in the 20 years since our conversation. And now Rebecca Solnit is taking on globalization.
One of the things that's been really remarkable the last few years is the rise of the anti-globalization, anti-biotech, anti-genetic engineering movement around the world. I think just last week they had a huge anti-WTO demonstration or anti-globalization demonstration near Naples. And so there is this global movement, and I wish it didn't take evil to bring out this kind of good, but we do have an extraordinary movement that I think what's happened in San Francisco, the resistance that's happened in San Francisco, is very much connected to. How do you have local control? How do you have social and ecological and complexity, the kind of humanistic biodiversity and a literal biodiversity and things like that? How do you protect the small, the local, the vulnerable, the complex, the non-economically meaningful against this kind of cavalry stampede of global capitalism that we're facing? And I think that what happened in Seattle with the WTO, what happened in San Francisco with the new board of supervisors and the posters in the streets is really all part of the same campaign to keep a world that's livable, not only for all the species and all the ecosystems, but for all the sort of little people, all the small farmers, the campesinos, the poets, the mothers, and all these things that are being trampled by global capital and its absolute ruthless pursuit of maximum profit.
The piece I just edited with Mike Davis, and in a way you all share those ideas, you, Gray Brecken, and Mike Davis, that a city really needs open space.
Yeah, there was a sense in old San Francisco, my own neighborhood had multiple vacant lots where houses had burnt down or something, and they grew all kinds of really wonderful, beautiful, lush weeds that harbored a lot of butterflies and a little bit of wildlife. And there's just a sense in the city that not every acre had to produce a product. It was kind of like the farmers who plow around the tree and leave the tree standing with the birds' nests in it. The new San Francisco, they have to cut down the tree because they want to maximize the profit on every square yard, and the trees are in their way. The trees, of course, in this sense, are the vacant lots, the abandoned buildings. This kind of romantic ruin that was part of the post-industrial city particularly, that I think was very much part of the aesthetics and that kind of melancholy, but the romantic melancholy of the 1970s and 80s. I was in New York looking at photographs by Peter Hujar, a wonderful photographer who photographed that romantic ruin of the city and had a kind of idealism, a kind of passion that is hard to find in young artists now, because I think they're all living in the Starbucks city where every square inch where people used to dream and squat and plot and perform has been filled in by, you know, spangly sweater boutiques and coffee chains and things like that. It was the Peter Hujar show was an extraordinary reminder of how much we've lost in the economic boom. The texture of the city, the dream space of the city, the breathing space of the city, the squatter space of the city, the space for the poor, the space for the marginal, the space for the butterflies who feed on our vacant lots.
In looking at these very intriguing modern urban historians and critics of urban planning, what they all have in common is to demand that open space not just happen and be left alone, but that it become an essential part of city planning.
I think open space and public space, to me open space sounds like space like Golden Gate Park and all the little parks around the city where you can stroll and sunbathe and throw sticks for dogs and take kids to play, but also public space where people can gather, where people can really participate in public life. There are cities now where it's impossible to be a member of the public. There's literally no place in which that public life can take place. And that was a big focus of urbanist discourse in the 1990s. The thing that we really didn't realize until recently that I tried to address in Hollow City is that there's another crisis, which is that you can empty out the private space in which public life arises, both the people who protect public space and open space, and the people who bring a lot of the life to it, the mime troupe who does, you know, in Shakespeare in the Park, who do theater in the parks every summer, the people who organize parades and festivals and demonstrations in the streets, which I think is the true highest urban use of streets, the people who do these posters and other kinds of things that make for a rich, richly textured, participatory urban experience, urbanism in its ideal form, that you can hollow them out of their private spaces and thus impoverish the public life, or you can build cities without public space and open space at all. And those are both problems. One of the things that I saw a lot in the New San Francisco was people who seem to come here from the suburbs and suburbanized cities who don't understand that the whole city should be your home. You don't need to have everything at home. You don't, because you can go to the movie theater for your entertainment. You can go to the community pool for your swimming. You can go to the library for your books. That true city life is about all these shared institutions that mean you can live in a small space for your private space, because the whole city belongs to you, the libraries and the pools and the parks and the streets. And people really lost that sense, which is a kind of psychic impoverishment, the loss of a kind of open space in the imagination that I think is really important to preserve, protect, and encourage.
Now, looking at your book and these really amazing photos, you have a very contemporary feeling of being drawn into a period that spans about 2 years of city life. How does the book go beyond being a document of a period of San Francisco life?
Well, for one thing, the photographs go back to the 19th century. We got extraordinary photographs from Ira Nowinski, who did heroic work documenting the struggle over Yerba Buena Center, extraordinary photographs of these old men in their single-room occupancy hotels south of Market, hotels that have all been destroyed. We reproduced a guy named David Jones, I think, who did a lot of photographs of the Western Addition in the 40s and 50s. So there's a lot of archival photos that give you a sense of the city over a 50-year period particularly. But also, the big question was, what is at stake in San Francisco with this boom that happened? And so particularly the chapter, The Real Estate History of the Avant-Garde, looks at what the role of artists has been for cities and cities has been for artists over 150 years. The chapter, The Shopping Cart and the Lexus, looks at what has the relationship between poverty and wealth in the city been since World War II and in cities in general and things like that. So there are these larger histories. How do cities work? What do cities mean? What happens in cities that doesn't happen in small towns? And why is it important to preserve it? All these things were at stake in a very intense way during the dot-com boom, but they're all long-term, permanent, important parts of the sort of biodiversity of urban life that has to include the poor and the subversive and the bohemian and the creative and the socially engaged to be an urbanity that's worth fighting for.
That was Rebecca Solnit. We spoke in the summer of 2001 about her book, Hollow City, an illustrated record of a once beautiful city made ugly by the onslaught of money, gentrification, and urban development. The publisher Verso said about the book that it shows that wealth is just as capable of ravaging cities as poverty. Rebecca Solnit, by 2013, has written 13 books, among them A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, and River of Shadows, Edward Muybridge and the Technological Wild West. She has worked with climate change, Native American land rights, anti-nuclear and human rights, as an activist and journalist. Susan Schwarzenberg brought almost 200 photos into the book. She's an urban archaeologist who works with old photos, people's stories, and places. She is senior artist at the San Francisco Science Museum, the Exploratorium.
That was an archival program by TUC Radio, recorded in my former studio in a converted factory in the Mission District. I left San Francisco and am now living off the electric grid in the mountains of Mendocino County in a straw bale house. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Our email address is TUC@TUCRadio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.